automatic review, and I've pointed out that it can always have an automatic review. If anybody files a complaint, then the review is automatic. You don't need to have an extra provision for that. What you really need is an automatic independent investigation, and that, of course, is not being considered. But let's hear Scott talk about some of the issues that came up recently at City Council.
March 12th, we're talking to
Scott Graham.
And Scott, you're a seasoned observer of City Council. In fact, you were at the last Tuesday City Council meeting where a series of ineffectual and pointless amendments for the Citizens Police Review Board came up. I, of course, noted them. There was a question of a hearing officer in a body that's never had a hearing in its life and at this point isn't likely to, although who knows, they have three new members, let's be optimistic. There was some proposal about automatic review of police shootings. Note, not automatic investigation of police shootings, but let's look over the shoulders, let's peek over the shoulders of the cops into their files and see whether they have, is there any question, upheld the officers in the police shooting. And then there was some third thing about, I guess, times and dates of elections, and there was a fourth thing regarding some other matter. But you said that there was an interesting division in the question of Michael Hernandez, often regarded as the most conservative as well as the most inarticulate member of the City Council, and Catherine Byers, our new No Sleeping in Santa Cruz, thank you very much, Mayor.
Well, yeah, they voted together on not having a hearing officer. They thought that, well, Catherine came out saying that she thought the Police Review Board had the right people on it to be able to hold their own hearing if it ever came to a point where they would actually hold a hearing and they didn't need an officer. And I think one of the points that Keith Sugar was trying to make was that it would be good for them just to have the option of having a hearing officer, that if they got into a hearing that they thought the issues were too complicated for them to understand, that they should have somebody to go to without having to first come to the City Council and beg them for somebody to go to. Mm-hmm. That they should have an option of being able to hire or contract with some sort of hearing officer or whatever. I mean, I think they really need some sort of investigator or something myself.
So Byers and Hernandez were the only ones that voted against this amendment?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even something that they were voting on. It was that, because this thing hadn't been in front of the police union arbitrators or whoever has to okay anything that the Police Review Board does and as far as their structure. And so the first couple points on the agenda, they actually had already been reviewed by the police union arbitrators. And the that one thing about the hearing officer hadn't ever been brought up to the police yet. They were just voting on whether or not to send the city manager to talk to the police about it. And
so this wasn't a first reading of this particular part of the ordinance?
Right. This was just an actual
advisory.
Yeah, it was to advise staff, in this case the city manager, to hold a talk with the police on this particular issue.
You know, a lot of the concern about the CPRB originally was that poor people, homeless people, were getting hassled by cops. And as well as other people as well, and that there should be a real review process to deal with those cases, whether they be rare or not. Some felt that they were more average than rare, where people were being hassled by police, and the only real review was an internal affairs, cops looking at cops process. Of course, for the last 5 years, the CPRB has created and weakened form by Scott Kennedy, and as acceded to, I might add, by Catherine Byers, who was also a part of that creating process. There has been no real review. I think two or three homeless complaints at the most have ever been sustained, and we've never heard about any kind of disciplinary consequences for any of these, the very few that, complaints that are sustained. The last 17 have not been sustained, and of course we have, I guess, some hope because there's a new police review board group coming on, and three new appointees. But you have a situation where Cynthia Matthews, who has an appointee kind of in her pocket and is refusing to bring out a name, holds the balance of power, and we have a sort of a 3-3 tie. What's your assessment? Should we be paying any attention?
I'm not sure. If it's 3-3 right now or if it's 4-2. I mean, I don't know. Once the three new members get on, I'm not sure who Catherine's appointee was. So I don't know where
Lisa Rose, I think.
Okay, so has she been firmly behind not reviewing anything?
She has never asked for a public hearing. She has never asked for an independent investigation. Happy John Dine was properly shot by that valiant officer, Carey, in a mistaken fit of whatever. And no, Lisa Rose cut back oral communications time. to essentially one-sixth of what it was at the Citizens Police Review Board. At one point, they were going to have a sergeant-at-arms instituted to deal with me, even though all I did was point out that they were giving the Police Officers Association union person more time than they were giving ordinary citizens, you know, to comment on substantive matters on the agenda. Now, Lisa Rose, I'm afraid, is not our ideal valiant defender of the people, as you might expect from an appointee of Catherine Byers. I think, I'm not sure if she's actually...
Well, if that's the case, then Cynthia Matthews' appointee, whoever it might end up being, would probably tilt the balance of power towards the conservative members then. So it would actually end up being a 3-4 with the fourth person. I mean, I don't foresee Cynthia picking any liberals to be on this kind of thing.
That's a good point. On the other hand, there is a 4-3 majority on the city council that can tell Cynthia Matthews appoint someone who's halfway decent or forget it.
Well, they already did that to one of her choices, so I would imagine if she has any brains, she'll run it by a few of them, or at least a couple of them, before she brings it up, or maybe she'll come up with a list of 2 or 3 people, and they'll do the...
Maybe she'll run it by Tim, let's have a consensus on human rights before we let them sleep, Fitzmaurice.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Tim's the hardest one to get to, I think, as far as being able to sit down and talk to him. Well, I never tried to sit down and talk with Hernandez or Matthews or Rockin, but...
I always say hello to them, and they frequently don't respond.
Huh.
Anyway, I'm going to have to run off to a movie. This business of actually interviewing real people is getting me down.
All right, well, have fun.
Thank you. We're talking to an...
For Radio Santa Cruz, you're on the air.
Oh, that was a cute tape.
Oh, it sounds like David Silva.
Yeah, the Police Officers Association is not a union, Robert, and those of us that are unionists really, really would wish that people wouldn't adapt the language of the police department when they call themselves union.
Hey, I trust my local police department.
Yeah,
don't you?
Well, get over it. Also, that all that stuff that's being brought up on the Citizens Police Review Board now is from the old Citizens Police Review Board. It's nothing that was fashioned or designed by the new Citizens Police Review Board. So that's before you see from the new Citizens Review Board, it's going to be, you know, probably another month or two. So don't characterize this as a result of the election. This is pre-election directives that this all came out of.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go to talk about the debate, whether Silva or Rodkin won.
Now, we should say we are talking to David Silva, one of the debaters. What did you feel about the fine performance of the moderator, Robert Norris?
I thought that was the biggest problem.
I see.
You know, a half-hour introduction, and then giving what I thought was going to be a chance for us to have an opening. I had my head cleared for that, and then I end up responding to 13 questions that I have to have 10 minutes to answer to. It was kind of really threw me off balance, and I'm not making apologies for myself. As far as I'm concerned, if you're going to give big time chunks, Rodkin's always going to squeeze in 5 lies with this one point that you're going to be arguing with. And so the big time chunks in the format, it's whether it's your fault or their fault.
Dave, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
What do you think did we learn from Rodkin that is going to be most productive in the discussions ahead with the community?
You're trying to keep this positive, aren't you?
Well, I'm trying to have us not get mired down in what we didn't do in the debate, which is really kind of secondary.
Well, I would like to correct a couple things, though. I mean, he's put out in the community now, and it's probably just the radicals and progressives mostly that were listening, but it was in the paper, and there's a lot of people out there that are listening. He's put out in the community that this 3 new people that were elected by a small few and that they only speak to a small few and only had the sense of a small few, and then coming into office, they all of a sudden had a reality awakening, and therefore they didn't repeal the sleeping ban. Well, that's just so much bullshit. That's not what the new coalition was about, and that's not the process that happened. And so, I really, really want to make sure that people don't fall for that kind of crap, first of all. And I think maybe you kind of lent to that, because the whole idea of, the negotiations were a failure, does not help when it comes to what we've had to accept with Catherine Byers, is that she wants an incremental approach. But it does not mean that the direction of this change is what he's saying it is. he's wrong. He's going to have the rude awakening. It may be very, very slow. But you know, this coalition, this new coalition that formed, and these new city council member did talk to the whole city. And when we were on the street speaking to this, getting in signatures for the sleeping ban, we did speak to common citizens, ordinary citizens, and they do think the sleeping ban, you know, should be repealed. And when we went to this task force process, when we went to the neighborhood associated meetings, when they heard about our initiative, they said, well, gee, yeah, something like that, safe zones, you know. You know, there's a little bit of the NIMBY factor involved there, but still, just the same, they do not want people ticketed for sleeping. Everywhere we went, that was that way. Even in the most hostile neighborhood at Harvey West, there was a good number of people that thought, you know, that the criminalizing people for sleeping was wrong. Do something about it. They were telling Catherine and the task force to do something about it. What Catherine has done is passed it on to a complete citizens committee.
Actually, she hasn't done anything about it, and there is no citizens committee coming up on the Tuesday city
council
agenda.
It will be that's what the recommendation was February 23rd. I don't know what you're talking February 23rd. I know that they haven't acted on all the recommendations yet, Robert. And I think it's very unfortunate it's not on this particular city council agenda. And I know that's a slowing down of the process even further. And if to get something on the ballot, if that's going to be the result, or to get an actual standing commission, if that's going to be the result, it looks like we're looking quite a ways down the road.
I think there is a
notion that this is incrementalism that she wants, and
yeah,
that she is turning it over to the citizens.
I agree with you that I think that Rodkin was wrong, you know, as he often is, in stating that the city council members encountered this great, you know, landslide of let's violate homeless people's civil rights because we need to. And I think you're quite right in your assessment of what was found through the task force.
Yeah.
But I think we also have to point out, and I'm sure you pointed it out as well, that the city council refused to respond to the obvious facts that it had learned, that Fitzmaurice, Crone, Sugar, and Byers essentially deep-sixed the issue. And
well, I don't say it's deep-sixed. I said I think it's just put over on the side burner, and it's going to be a citizens committee, and the citizens committee is going to come back with force, I hope. I think
you're
it was
much
quite
more
clear.
Than I don't.
I know I'm more positive.
No, I think we got to be positive. But I guess we disagree on this. I think the way to be positive is to get some sort of a series of protests going that acknowledge the fact that this issue has been buried.
I've never discouraged that this not be handled on all fronts.
Right. Sure.
I've always said, you know, if you're young and you're strong, or if you're stubborn and weak and sick and foolish like me, get out there and demonstrate and let them know that this is wrong.
It's
a human rights issue. There's no consensus about it.
I think if people had realized in December, as I did, that this was going nowhere, which it went nowhere, then we would have had a real strong series of protests this winter that would have made it go somewhere.
Yeah.
And because instead we listened to voices that said, let's give them time, they're a new council.
We've all been defused and decentralized and disorganized and by this process. There's no doubt about it. So that's why I'm trying to say, have faith. You know, we are going to win this. You know, not to let that image, you know, and I know it's important for you
have
to criticize.
Have faith, but don't have faith in this another bathroom task force or a homelessness task force that Crone puts together. I mean, I guess, you know, you and I differ on this issue. I don't think we should have faith in that. I think we have to have faith in what we ourselves can do.
Yeah.
And right now, I mean, I want to give you credit because I was saying, oh, you know, David Silva, you know, is just getting crumbs and so forth. But frankly, you know, I don't see a lot of protesting going on out there on the streets. I don't see a lot of organizing going on. I'm trying to do a little, but it's not quite coming together, and we wouldn't have what we have even now, which is minor, but it is something, you know, it is a real thing in the sense that it is a minor liberalization, the reduction of the fine, the reduction from misdemeanor to infraction.
You know how I hate to be associated with the word liberal in any way, Robert.
Right, but I'm saying that because, you know, you rushed in with this stuff, which I was critical of you for doing, and I still am ambivalent on the issue. You know, there has been some, and more important, there's been publicity around this issue, endless publicity, which, you know, not as good as we want, but certainly more than there's ever been before.
Sentinel actually uses the word sleeping ban now, which is, you know, something both you and Rodkin failed, and you know, you both dominated the debate. You know, I felt like I was, a lot of times, just a witness there. It was really kind of annoying.
I was very laid back. My mismanagement of this debate on Thursday, is what you're saying.
Yeah. What was it, my point? You and him both exchanged the terms camping ban and sleeping ban way too often. He, of course, made it, you know, that's his style. That's what he wants. That's what he's wanted to do. And you bit the bait on that a few times. It's a tricky one, you know. But it's one of the
sleeping ban, not camping ban.
Yeah, sleeping ban, not camping ban. It's the very first thing when we started the Committee to Repeal Sleeping Ban that we thought that we had to really get across to people.
And of course, for those who are listening out there, the sleeping ban sections are only a part of the whole camping ordinance. And that was one of our criticisms of Catherine Byers, that instead of dealing with that issue, which we had really focused on for a year, the sleeping ban, she opened it up to the broader camping ordinance and made it kind of a free-for-all that terrorized the business and the resident community.
We went into these task force meetings and these focus group meetings, especially if there's neighborhood people involved. Mm-hmm. They had been contacted by their steering committees and so forth that, you know, that the entire camping ordinance was going to be overturned. So they came here to...
Right.
We spent the whole first 7 weeks of people showing up to fight against the whole entire camping ordinance being overturned.
Heard.
Well, my God, you know...
Yeah. We never heard from Crone and Sugar that there was, you know, that this was a sleeping thing that they were looking for, not a camping thing, this was a human rights issue that we had, that we were committed to deal with. Instead, you know, it was this sort of vague, neutral, transparent posture that failed to advocate the issue before the groups that really had to have the hard discussions with. But let me get back, David, to what did we learn from what Rotkin said? What kind of admissions did he make that can be useful in educating the community?
I haven't finished that review, and I wish you'd give me your copy of the tape, because my copy of the tape that was made home while I was on the show is inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
He made quite a few admissions. He's had to go along with the pack now. You know, he definitely likes to go along with the pack, hoping that he can be at least the sidekick, if not the leader.
Mm-hmm.
There was. I'm trying to think just what were some of the important things he made. Well, he's always made the admission, whether people realize or not, that there was no there's no magnet theory for social services, which I still find, you know, just befuddling.
For those who do, again, to clarify this for our listeners, Mike Rotkin,
Thank
the council
you,
member, suggested that it's okay for him to push for social services because that won't bring a lot of people to town, but if he pushes for a safe place for people to sleep or sleeping zones or a campground, that would bring a lot of people to town. And he presented absolutely no evidence whatsoever for this. And I think this was it seems if it's going to be one, it's going to be the other. Although, I mean, or I suppose you might say the only reason that he says that there's a difference is because one of them is a position he supports and one of them is a position he opposes, and therefore he musters all these spurious phantom arguments, or at least this particular phantom argument, on that behalf,
he certainly didn't want to talk about who would come back to town, and I think that's going to become a really important question within the next 6 months. The who will come back to town are the families broken up by this law, the people who have been driven out of town by this law. If we get a hold on eviction, get a hold on rent, and we get a hold on the police's pet ordinance of the sleeping ban, if we can get a hold on those three things, whether we do it incrementally, whether we do it by revolution, or whether we do it by going to the ballot the first Tuesday in June before the students leave, you know, whatever we do, as long as we get a hold on those three things, the word is going to get out to families, and there will be people coming back to town who've been driven out of town. We've attacked the lower third income of this town viciously. Now, since the university came to town, really.
Notice you're saying coming back to town.
Yeah.
You're not talking about a whole new
I'm not talking about migrations of people that have come here because they have for the right to sleep outside at night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not talking about people they're going to be rushing here because rent and eviction is going to be stabilized. We're having an eviction crisis. I mean, it's an eviction spree that's going on for the past 3 years. Very, 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 very vicious eviction crisis, and what came out, well, this is one of the things that really Catherine Byers and I just spoke about Thursday a lot, is that what she's trying to do with restructuring government is that she's trying to make it work. One of the problems has been is that, you know, you were in workshops 2 years ago when there were proposals that came out of that on for homelessness and housing.
Mm-hmm.
And any issue out there, anybody that's an activist that's gone to city council with issues, you will see city council not only maybe water down what you wanted, but also spice it up by adding directives to staff to do this and to do that and to do this, and none of those things ever get done. So one of the problems that we have is that we're sort of satisfied that evening, you know,
and
we'll come back months later, and the city council will once again reorder staff to do something.
Right.
You know,
it's
not being done. We don't have democracy.
It's interesting. It's interesting, David.
Because of staff.
It's interesting, yeah, that we asked the city council, particularly the new council members, to get themselves either volunteers or interns to help them with the heavy loads that they have. I'm not
aware. Just to do the things that they've agreed to do already would be something.
And I'm not aware that any of them have done this yet. And this is 6 months later we're talking, or 5 months later. And I think that what I'm seeing, and I don't like to admit this, but I am seeing city council members slipping into the old mold. I mean, that is what is going on here.
I think Chris has faced this on head on with some of the reformations that he's talking about, and of course Catherine's whole disheveling and complete reorganizing of government, putting things back on the city commissions rather than on these, you know, politicized subcommittees. I think that's the beginning of the process, and I think Chris really is trying to do something about this process. I mean, even to the extent of this, what affects him personally is having some daycare available. So it's really, really sad that, you know, we've been here in office. You know, we have been in power. The people have been in power now for 6 months, and the city government is so structured and so bent and so inactive and unable to act that, you know, so little seems to be coming out. Let's not abandon ship completely. But for those of you who do want to abandon ship completely, I always advocate complete, total nonviolent civil disobedience is the strongest way to get your message across. They got the guns. They got the numbers. Don't even think of anything stupider than nonviolent resistance. Absolute, total, you know, blocking of streets and closing down of the city's normal operations is an effective way if your message is understood. But if you let the media take control of your message, it doesn't make any fucking much damn bit of difference.
Well, it's kind of hard to avoid having the media take control of our message.
If you have a good, clear, nonviolent, and you have a good theme and a good, and you have clear symbols, and you're leafleting the streets so that the people can join you, you always want the people to join you. And I always put out a call, and I'll put out a call now, even to the police. Do civil disobedience when it comes to this sleeping ban. Do not give sleeping tickets. Save your soul. Do civil disobedience on this. Not issue sleeping
tickets.
Well,
it's a nice thing to say, David, but
save your soul.
No police officer in town is going
to
respond to that.
I'm sorry to disagree with you.
Well,
I know otherwise.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good.
When it comes to doing civil disobedience, you know, we're out there to win people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're out there to win people. The numbers are too small in the opposition here.
You know, we have a CPRB meeting coming up tomorrow. I continue to talk about this, and I kind of criticize myself for doing this because I know that the CPRB is pretty useless, and I would love to see some alternate group,
subdivision
like,
of internal
like
affairs,
a
isn't it?
Police, yeah, like a police tribunal come forward, a citizens tribunal on the police, and I know that there are some folks who really want to work on that, but I mentioned the police review board because I guess in a way it's a place where critics of the police can gather, as well as little groupies who favor the police. And that's tomorrow at 5:30 at City Hall. And one of the things they are going to be talking about is what a new police review board member, Arnold Leff, doctor, I think he's Fitzmaurice's appointee. I've talked to him at some length, and the jury is still out on him, as it is on most of these people for me. He's going to be bringing up the issue of inquiries versus complaints. And the only reason that, I mean, this is a very technical distinction between one kind of complaint and another kind of complaint, but what it really shows is how Chief Steve Belcher of the police department has been making his own law. And I think that this is an important issue to bring forward because the ultimate recourse, disciplinary-wise, other than the courts, which, as you know, David, takes years. You got assaulted in 1996, and you're still in the courts.
Well, yeah, I went through the regular channels like the citizens. Police Review Board, but Cynthia Matthey held a vote in her pocket and didn't make an appointment, and so I went through the whole 6 months till the thing expired.
Mm-hmm.
Now the city is in liability for several million, where she could have avoided that.
Right. Well, yeah. So what I'm saying is that it might be useful to show up at the CPRB to, I'm always wary of inviting people to come to those meetings. It is happening on Monday. I guess I'm going to show up there to check out this inquiry complaint dispute, perhaps. It's, for those of you who don't know, what the police department now does is if it calls some things inquiries, which are just sort of, you know,
What that police department does is outrageous. They bury and hide stuff is what they do.
That's in essence what inquiries do. An inquiry is something that does not have to be forwarded to the Citizens Police Review Board. Now, actually,
they have no record of anything anymore when you make a complaint.
Actually, the police department keeps a record of inquiries, and I think at one point Belcher did give those to the police.
They've never been able to dig up a copy of any of my inquiries or complaints.
Interesting. So, in other words, they have a record of some, but not a record of others.
Right. It's a convenience for them to bury and hide.
But you know, the focus on these bureaucratic processes, I think, and that's one of the problems I have when I talk to you is, and I talk to myself about it. It's a temptation for those of us to sit like myself and pontificate about what's going to happen tomorrow at the Citizens Police Review Board when nothing is going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
And what we really want to do is make something happen. And I guess the same thing is true with the city council meeting on Tuesday, unless you have some further, some enlightenment for us about what may be coming up then. That at Tuesday, every second and fourth Tuesday, it's been 2:00 rather than 3:30. The afternoon session of the city council is earlier. There's an evening session at 7:00, and the afternoon session.
Well, I understand. Mike Hernandez and Cynthia Matthews are going to introduce a bill to make it illegal to receive free dental care.
Oh, well, that's certainly fair, I must say.
I think that's fair, and that fits right in with the Rotkin philosophy on human rights and how human rights should be challenged. And if you challenge human rights like that, then you get more out of the system. Yeah, I think that would be the logical thing that we could expect.
That's a commendable perspective. anyway, it is a 2:00 and a 7:00 evening sessions. But do you have any other? I guess you haven't got the agenda.
I had a brief review of the agenda done to me about with a phone, as you know, but I haven't seen it. I think there are some important things on it. I can't remember what right now. The Citizens Police Review Board. If there's anybody out there that wants to follow civic government and watch our city government in action, underlining the inaction, you really should witness how they're going to be handling things.
The inaction of the city government.
Now there is of course, we did have a revolution at the polls in November, and so there is, there's two forces that you'll see operating, and it's very difficult to see the force of change in the city council.
It's almost invisible.
we're still hoping that very soon these new appointees and so forth will be taking some of these old tired steers by the horns and producing some stuff to actually come forth to city council. Mm-hmm. And we'll see. But meanwhile, it doesn't hurt at all to go and watch the dying old forces and the transformation of the new forces as they engage the city staff.
And there are some new forces on campus. I know that Cal Perg is starting to organize around issues of the sleeping ban and homelessness. That's a student group, Students Against the Sleeping Ban, and there were half a dozen to a dozen student organizations that supported ending the sleeping ban. And students have returned, and of course there's an article in this week's City on a Hill Press about the failure of the Byers City Council. I call it now the Byers sleeping ban because she's the one that's keeping it in place. It is being mentioned. The problem is the weather's been nasty. Folks, again, as Students Against the Sleeping Ban advocate Brian Crowley, as a fellow called in, was speaking about, said that, there's so many causes that what we need to as I said, this prison reform, the prison industrial complex, break it down. That's just really important issue. I'm hoping that we can do some sort of analysis locally.
Well, the sleeping ban is our
prison is
sleeping
like.
Ban is Santa Cruz's own special brand of engagement with the war and the poor, and I think we should recognize that. And anybody that's advocating maintaining, keeping the sleeping ban so the police will have a right to not to ignore the Fourth Amendment should realize that that's war on the poor, that's the failed war on drugs. It's all that kind of mentality that has started taking over and eroding our Constitution away. If Jerry Brown had his way, we'd all look at the Second Amendment and rise up. But I think we have to acknowledge that our city plays the war on the poor. We play the war on the drugs, and people like Mike Rockin can hold up children and say, what about the teeth of these poor children in an argument about the sleeping ban? So we are just as decadent and corrupt as the rest of the pharaonic America that is the world imperial power.
Oh, I don't like to call Mike Rutkin a we. I don't think he's a part of my we at all. I think he's on the other side.
We Americans all, we Santa Cruzans all, are just as corrupt and embroiled in the war on the poor.
I think there's a difference between you and me and Mike Rutkin and the politicians on the city council.
Pardon?
I really do. I think there's a difference. I think when you know, when Fitzmaurice sells out on this issue in the vote and doesn't vote to make a change in the sleeping ban, I think when Keith Sugar, you know, makes only and Chris Crone don't take a really strong
stance. I would like
stance.
To take some responsibility for the failure. I think we all should take some responsibility for the failure.
I
should
have
got the damn thing on the ballot. No matter how much the police stole petitions, no matter how much the police drove our homeless petition gatherers out of town, we should have gone ahead and just pushed on, and when we didn't make that deadline, just started right over again. Mm-hmm. I think it's a failure for us not to get on the ballot, because it's one we could have won. It would be over with now. We wouldn't have to be wasting so much energy on it. I hate to say the word wasting, because, you know, it's such a basic human right. Okay, Robert.
Hey, David.
Are you having an invasion there?
Having an invasion of rapscallions. So
great.
Talk to you later, buddy.
Okie dokie.
Hey, thank you very much, David Silva.
Yeah, keep faith.
All right. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We have not been invaded by the FCC, but by the masses. The masses have arrived at the studio, and I'm going to have to deal with the masses. While I'm dealing with them, let's have a little music.
Well, Americans are very friendly people. And we'd like to be supportive if we can. If someone's running out of ammunition, we're proud to be the first to lend a hand. Yeah, let's just have the next war at the White House, so our president won't have so far to go. Let's have it in our own backyard the next time. Yeah, we'll host the show and bring the party home. War is hell, we know, but still we love it. We love it, but it's all so far away. Let's cook at home next time instead of cater. In honor of the good old CIA. Yeah, let's just have the next war at the White House, so our president can really see the show. We won't have to wait and see if they invite us. Appreciate our efforts. They don't know what it feels like to be free. But we're there in a flash if we smell trouble. But it's time to host a conflict in D.C. We'll have our world policemen fall right at the White House. Yeah, we'll have it in a language that we know. We'll barbecue our own backyard the next time. Yeah. Host the show and bring the party. Host the show and bring the party home.
And that's another favorite of mine from Carol Denny. Rather interesting, considering our exporting bombs to Serbia. A couple of interesting editorials in the San Francisco Examiner. I'd like to read them to you. You are in the last 20 minutes of Bathrop Spears Broadsides, 96.3 FM, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm your host, Bathrop Spear Robert Norse. This is an editorial by Amtabal Pal, who is editor of the Progressive Media Project in Madison, Wisconsin. In the midst of the current humanitarian crisis in Kosovo, comes the fifth anniversary of one of the biggest human catastrophes of the century, a catastrophe the world stood by and let happen. On April 6, 1994, a plane carrying the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi crashed under mysterious circumstances. They were both killed. The Hutu-dominated Rwandan government accused the Tutsi-led rebel Rwandan Patriotic Front of shooting down the plane and unleashed a program of genocide against the country's minority Tutsi and moderate Hutu populations. This is in the Central African region. In the next 100 days, at least 500,000 people, possibly as many as 1 million, were killed in an orgy of orchestrated violence. Countless others were wounded, raped, terrorized, and orphaned. The international community did nothing to stop the killing frenzy. In fact, the UN Security Council's initial reaction was to reduce the size of its peacekeeping operation in Rwanda to one-tenth of its initial size. As a result, by the end of April, only 387 UN troops and 72 UN observers were left in the country. The tiny force performed some heroic deeds and saved some lives, but was unable to prevent the genocide. Only in late June did a controversial UN-authorized French force, this again was back in 1994, accused by many of protecting the genocidal government more than the victims, arrive in the country. The United Nations had ample warning of the genocide, but failed to take preventive measures. Hutu militias had started stockpiling weapons in preparation for the killings many months before. The Rwandan government had ordered all Tutsis in Kigali, Rwanda's capital, to register as a precursor to their elimination. Kofi Annan, the current Secretary General, who was then in charge of UN peacekeeping, knew all these things, but did not authorize the seizing of the weapons or the mobilization of an intervention force. Major General Romeo A. Dallari, the commander of the UN peacekeeping mission in Rwanda, later said that with 5,000 troops, he could have saved 500,000 lives. Annan has recently asked the Security Council for an independent inquiry into the reasons for the failure of the United Nations to intervene. The Security Council has agreed to the request. The United States had a major part in ensuring that the United Nations was paralyzed. Stung by the death of 30 U.S. soldiers in Somalia in 1993, the Clinton administration put the brakes on any moves to intervene. The United Nations had to learn when to say no, Clinton said at the time. While the genocide was occurring, the Clinton administration instructed State Department representatives to avoid using the term genocide in reference to the tragedy, since international law would then have compelled the United States and other major powers to intervene to stop the massacres. The Security General also avoided using the term. After the genocide commenced, UN Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali repeatedly went before the Security Council to ask for additional troops for Rwanda. Even after the Council finally agreed to send 5,500 troops, the United States and other Western countries forced a delay in sending them until the massacres had effectively ceased. Boutros-Ghali called the situation a scandal. The current U.S. Secretary of State and then U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, played a pivotal role in delaying U.N. action. Her name is rarely associated with Rwanda, but ducking and pressuring others to duck as the death toll leapt from thousands to tens of thousands was the absolute low point in her career as a stateswoman, writes Philip Gurevich in We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda. On a brief visit to Rwanda in March 1998, Clinton acknowledged his failure. We in the United States and the world community did not do as much as we could have and should have done to try to limit what occurred in Rwanda in 1994. The sins of the French government went far beyond simple failure to stop the genocide. Clinging to its old French-speaking ally, France played a major role in arming, training, and propping up the government that committed the butchery. Throughout the genocide, the French maintained contact with the brutal regime and even adopted its cover story that the killings were spontaneous, Tutsi instigated, and just an extension of the civil war. The current intervention in Kosovo vividly highlights the failure to act in Rwanda. Due to narrow self-interest, Western powers did not stop one of the biggest tragedies of the century. A greater indictment of the current global system would be hard to find. Of course, this is an article, Rwanda Revisited, Failed by the World, by Amit Bal Pal, in the April 8th San Francisco Examiner. And I guess the lesson I draw from this, and maybe, you know, one can draw a number of different lessons, is the Clinton administration is now beating the drums of war for, indeed, a great number of refugees, but a relatively small number of people killed. I think that the estimates are 2,000 or 3,000 people killed. Maybe it's more. Maybe it's 4,000 or 5,000 now. But when it came to hundreds of thousands, they took no action at all. And, you know, it's important to consider why the U.S. wants to intervene here in this, at this time in this place, and obviously what impact that's really having. Here's another article by Ingvar Carlson and Shridath Ramphal, Vigilantism Must Not Be New World Order. The United Nations Charter prescribes that no country or group of countries shall resort to the use of force against another, save in self-defense, except under the authority of the United Nations. NATO airstrikes against Yugoslavia have not been authorized by the United Nations. That authority was not even sought. They are therefore acts of aggression against a sovereign country. As such, they strike at the heart of the rule of international law and the authority of the United Nations. Because they are acts undertaken by the world's most militarily powerful countries, that damage is incalculable. A trend toward unilateral action in defiance of international norms became more pronounced once we entered a unipolar world. It is a trend that persists and with more boldness. The United States has imposed trade sanctions against European countries contrary to the rules of the World Trade Organization. Now Europe and North America have used massive force against Yugoslavia contrary to the UN Charter. Who is there to stop them and turn them back to the path of law, as President Eisenhower did to Britain and France at the time of Suez? And after this, who will there be to turn back other action in breach of the UN Charter? What if, in virtuous rage, China invades Taiwan, or the U.S. bombs Cuba, or Spain annexes Gibraltar? Will there be another set of norms that condemns these wrongs? And on what basis do we press the claims of disarmament in a world palpably no longer under the rule of law founded on the UN Charter? NATO countries assert their respect for the Charter of the United Nations and the norms of international law that arise from it. Europe, in particular, claims moral authority as a custodian of internationalism. Now the gamekeepers have turned poachers, posing as policemen. This temptation to assume police powers on the basis of righteousness and military strength is dangerous for world order and world peace. What results is a world ordered by vigilante action. We would not accept that in our national societies. Why should anyone think it is less dangerous in our global society? NATO countries are understandably frustrated in their efforts for peace in Yugoslavia, and are righteously and rightly indignant at the humanitarian wrongs committed by the Serbian regime. But if in our responses we become violators too, in the end we return to a dark time when might alone is right and law comes out of the barrel of a gun. This cannot be our signature as we turn the page into a new millennium. This is by Ingvar Carlsson, former Prime Minister of Sweden, and Shridath Ramphal, former Secretary General of the British Commonwealth. They are co-chairmen of the London-based Commission on Global Governance, also from the San Francisco Examiner of April 8th. So, as I look at the bombing in Serbia, and it's hard to avoid it as you see the newspapers day after day, you know, the obvious questions come up. One, is it doing any good? Is it resulting in the Serbian government's backing off of the burning, the killing, the making refugees of the Kosovians or the Kosovans? The Kosovnyards, or the folks in Kosovo. And I don't see that happening. I certainly don't have any words of sympathy for Milosevic and his policies, which I think have been disastrous in the last decade. But bombing Yugoslavia doesn't seem to be having the kind of effect that it's supposed to have, is the most obvious kind of ABC, duh, kind of thing, to which, of course, some people conclude, send in the ground troops. And that one, you know, makes me think of Yugoslavia as a territory which that kind of invasion is more likely to unify people against the Americans and the NATO forces and join in solidarity with the Yugoslavian regime. With the genocidal may be strong, but certainly they're engaging in a form of ethnic cleansing that is driving Albanians as a group out of their homes in Kosovo and driving them into situations of death and destruction. And so perhaps it isn't so strong. I'm not the international law expert, but it's real. And the question is, what do we do? And that was the question I put to a Serbian speaker who was on the air a week ago. And I don't know that he had an answer either. And the answer, of course, is not no answer. No, that can't be the answer either. So at the moment, I'm stymied. I don't know what to do. Maybe someone who is listening has an idea as to how to intervene in a fashion that will stop this kind of genocide, this murder of Albanians, this making hundreds of thousands of people homeless. The number is now up to 500,000. On the other hand, we hear stories of Yugoslavians who are not particularly friends of the regimes joining the standing on the bridges to stop the Allies from bombing the bridges in some of these cities. It's just horrendous. On another note, the new Street Spirit, the homeless newspaper, is out. It has arrived. For those of you who are interested in the April issue of Street Spirit, just hike on down to, well, try in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. You can often find Job Finder John, as I call him, the homeless coordinator of vendors selling Street Spirit and other vendors. Costs a buck, but it has lots of good information on it. And the money, I think, goes to a worthy cause, people who need it. And, you know, it's really important to have a buck to get in out of the rain these days, and particularly when it's illegal to sleep outside or cover up with blankets. It's nice to have a dollar to get into Denny's to buy a cup of coffee where you can sit for an hour or so. So I suggest Street Spirit, both as a source of information and something good to do.
Geopolitics and disarmament.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be advocating the United States of America surrendering its sovereign rights to the UN disarmament.
I'm sorry, go ahead. That doesn't characterize my position, but go ahead.
What is your position?
Well, I think I was saying the U.S. should stop bombing the Serbians. And NATO should stop acting, should stop bombing the Serbians as a unilateral action. That was something that I tended to agree with the columnist on. And I say that both because, in terms of its impact on international law, and also it's a failed policy in terms of actually accomplishing its own objectives. But I don't know that I'm suggesting that the U.S. should abandon its sovereignty to the United Nations. I think it's true that, you know, these bombing activities should be, I think, undertaken under UN auspices if they're being done as some sort of international response to genocide.
If the UN becomes the repository of decisions about where force is used,
mm-hmm.
how force is justified, in essence, the United States of America, in order for that to happen, would have to surrender its sovereignty.
Well, it's hard.
I mean, those are the practical realities.
Well, the reality...
Let me just say this. The practical reality, the overwhelming historical reality, going back as far as you want to go back, is preponderant influence, is hegemony, is somebody has overwhelming superiority, and it lasts for so long until it's overwhelmed by opposition. And to claim that we should lay down our guard, I think is
no, well, that,
blatantly
that
absurd.
Doesn't characterize my position at all, Bob.
In fact, if we are lucky, we
lay
should...
Lay down your guard is different than bombing the hell out of the Serbians. Come on, give me a break.
If we are astute...
Nobody's invading the U.S.,
We would
Bob.
Attempt to ensure that the United States of America, in perpetuity, retains hegemony over planet Earth.
You're obviously a big U.S. nationalist, and I can hear that, rather than an internationalist, but I think that the point of the UN Charter was that,
a nationalist versus an internationalist.
Wait a minute, Bob. You respond to an attack on you. That is something where the use of arms is appropriate. Or you get together and as a community of nations, you decide when to start, engaging in warfare on another country. I mean, that's sort of not just the UN. That's the old theory of people getting together to make these decisions rather than having an international anarchy.
We don't have international anarchy.
Oh, I think so.
We have American hegemony. And to deny that, I think, is downright silly. Certainly, we have inherited historical influence, and NATO, there apparently is a much deeper sense of affiliation with those that have power in America with NATO. I think that's changing. I think that America's role post-1989 as a police a country, it's very difficult. We're going to make mistakes. And I'm not saying that I'm for the bombing of Serbia. I think it was a very, very difficult call in an extremely complicated real world in which, once again, if we were to ever let down our guard, somebody else would pick it up. And who better than the United States of America to have this kind of power and authority?
I think we don't need one. We need a group of nations together, Bob.
You see, that sounds real pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It just sounds pretty. It has no practicality. It has what it would have would be it would be the ultimate authoritarian nightmare.
Well, I disagree with you on that, but I don't have a lot of time to talk about it since we're close to 1:30. Anything else you want to say on any other subjects?
I would say that I think it's important for Americans to look at the world post-1989 and ponder what our role might be, and ponder that we have overwhelming superiority militarily, and if that is not a good thing, what are you going to replace it with?
I don't think in a nuclear age anyone has overwhelming superiority. I think you have mutual suicide pacts.
Well, I think that the historical record proves, even with the failure in Vietnam, that the United States of America has overwhelming superiority and has since Hiroshima.
Mm. Well, I'm a little bit nervous
and
to hear
certainly,
that, to
certainly
hear that
the
Russia's
Berlin,
turning its missiles
certainly
on us.
Since the Berlin Wall went down.
Well, I've heard of missiles being targeted on, you know, on NATO targets
well,
again.
Well, they have always been. They have always been and probably will remain.
That's not my understanding.
As they do in China, and they can realign missiles, I think, within 15 minutes or something.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is the real world, right, that
mm-hmm.
we're talking about, that has these capabilities and has shown itself to be willing to even exercise those capabilities.
Well, that's, you know, you've got some fine language there, Bob, but I think it's covering some pretty dastardly actions. But it's not something that I can talk about because I'm afraid the little red hen is going to force me out of the studio very shortly.
Thank you for letting me get on the air.
Sure. Thank you for coming on with your ever-controversial comments. And we are getting phone calls. And since I've got a break here, let's see if we can answer a few of them. Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple of comments about Bob. My name's Will, and I'm an activist around town most of the time. But anyway, I was just wanting to point out how dangerous what he was sounding, or dangerously close to the Nationalistic Socialist Party of Germany party line about how they had to keep order in the world. The Nationalist Socialist Party of Germany being the Nazis, and how they had the duty, because they were superior militarily, to dictate the will of the world and to spread their own hegemony or hegemonic force over the world. I don't know, that just scared me very badly.
Well, I think that's really an appropriate characterization. I'm surprised I didn't think of it, but that's, of course, they felt they were racially superior and that they were, but again, it's my nation, right or wrong. My nation can, you know, should do what it can, do what it's, you know, it has the power to do. Might makes right. I mean, there is a point in which it's important to recognize what really goes down, and I think that we got to acknowledge that, you know, the United States has a significant amount of military power, but I think people have forgotten that we're on a precipice here. You know, we are on a precipice, and we are still half an hour away from world destruction. That is still the truth.
Yeah.
And even beyond that, even if it doesn't result in that kind of a nuclear exchange, the question of the value of... I guess I put the question to you. Do you have any thoughts about what should we be advocating be done in Serbia to stop the kind of
slaughter that's going on by an illegitimate regime.
Well, I don't have any concrete solutions since I'm not informed on every single angle of the details. However, I know that bombing the hell out of Serbian civilians isn't doing anything to stop Milosevic from creating his ethnic cleansing or genocide. Sending in ground troops to occupy that region would constitute simply an aggressive takeover of that country. And so I think a lot more needs to be done on an international diplomatic front. And if it is in fact a genocide and an ethnic cleansing, something has to be done, but it is not up to us unilaterally to decide that we don't like what's going on, and therefore we're going to go bomb the hell out of civilians in order to express our dissent.
Thank you, caller.
All right, thanks.
And we, of course, have an opinion from Howard Zinn in the Anderson Valley Advertiser, 10 points, the Kosovo situation, which I'm going to read here for people's thought. One, Milosevic and his Serb forces are committing atrocities. Two, bombing won't help, it will only make things worse, and that is already evident. Indeed, as the New York Times has it on Thursday morning, the administration was told by the CIA and Pentagon people that bombing would speed up Milosevic's ethnic cleansing, but it went ahead anyway. This means that not only was Clinton deceiving the public when he said his aim was bombing was to help the people of Kosovo, but that he embarked on the bombing campaign with a reckless disregard for what would happen to the Kosovars as a result. The bombing would only create more victims on both sides. Innocent Yugoslav civilians will die, so that both Kosovars and Serbians end up as victims of our policy. Three, the Kosovo Liberation Army may not represent the wishes of the Kosovar people because it decided to turn to armed struggle to gain independence, ruthlessly putting their countrymen at risk when a more protracted nonviolent campaign of resistance was already going on and should have continued. I think of South Africa, where a decision to engage in armed struggle would have led to a bloody civil war with huge casualties, most of them black. Instead, the African National Congress decided to put up with apartheid longer, but wage a long-term campaign of attrition with strikes, sabotage, economic sanctions, international pressure, and it worked. Four, the United States does not have a humanitarian aim in this situation. Its foreign policy has never been guided by such concerns, but by political power, economic interest, and sometimes a motive more elusive, like machismo. We want to show the world we are number one, as president after president has reiterated during and after Vietnam. Five, the hypocrisy of the Clinton administration is evident with just a bit of recent history. For instance, when Chechnya rebelled, desiring independence from Russia, just as Kosovo wants it now, and the Russian army moved in doing terrible things to the people there, Clinton did not oppose this. Indeed, in fielding one reporter's question, he compared the situation to the American Civil War, where Lincoln would not permit the Confederacy to secede. Will a statue of Yeltsin be erected alongside Lincoln's in D.C.? Six, there is no sensible military solution to the ethnic cleansing going on because it could only be stopped by putting in a large ground force, which would mean a full-scale war in which the present violence would be multiplied greatly. Seven, what is happening to the Kosovo people is heartrending, and now with the bombing we are adding Serbian victims to the lists of casualties. I think the only solution is a diplomatic one, forgetting the treaty the U.S. tried to force on Serbia. It will take a new agreement in which the Kosovites will have to settle for some form of autonomy, but no guarantee of independence. A compromise in order to have peace. The only way this diplomatic solution can come about is through the intercession of Russia, which is the only important power with influence over the Serbs. Eight, as a minor point, since any reference to international law is futile, it has been rather worthless for 50 years, the United States is violating the UN Charter by what it is doing. It is also violating the U.S. Constitution, which requires a declaration of war, and we are certainly waging war. Nine. Hey, the hen has arrived. NATO should be abolished. It is a military alliance at a time when we should be discarding military solutions, and its very existence encourages military solutions. Ten. To my surprise, I was invited to be on NBC cable news program on Saturday, and I was able to make a few points, that violent solutions only multiply whatever evil they are claimed to counter, that when the solution to a problem is elusive, you must at least start with one principle, the one told to medical students, do no harm. The U.S. and NATO, which is the creation of the U.S. and does its bidding, are floundering, and in the course of that doing enormous damage to human beings. It will require the citizens of the NATO countries, especially in the U.S., to shout their protest at what is going on and to demand a diplomatic solution. When a nation issues ultimatums, it leaves no room for compromise and ensures that war will continue. We learn from Vietnam the ruthlessness of leaders, the stupidity of experts must be countered by the courage, good sense, and persistence of the citizenry. That is Howard Zinn in the April 7th Anderson Valley Advertiser. Lots of interesting articles in that issue. I suggest you look at it. You can get a copy at the Book Loft, which is right next to the Rio Theater on Soquel and Seabright. This has been Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. I'm retiring a little late here, but that's because the hen apparently took her time coming to the show. So it's all her fault. Keep that in mind. Actually, I really appreciated the opportunity to be able to speak for a few minutes. Do you want me to proceed with my out theme, or do you want to go into your in theme there, Hen? The Hen is going to come in. I want to thank you. Please come back on Thursday. We're going to be returning at 6 o'clock for the next edition of Bathrobes Pierre.
Once upon a time, a long time ago, some kings and knights fought to overthrow the magical realms so that people wouldn't know the wonders and the powers of the mystical. Battles raged for 500 years till the magic in our hearts was reduced to fear. They thought they succeeded in wiping it out. But magic is here, hovering about. Deep within the world, what lives a little elf, and man that goes by the name of... Never dreamed. Gil will be confused in his acorn clogs when he drinks his very, very blueberry grog from the drinking horn that is really not a horn. But an ultimate security doesn't carry winkle sound. He wears a vest of green moss round his neck. He wears a Celtic cross, plays rickety-tickety on his blinking sticks. And he'll dance with fairies in the piney thick. They sing fiddity-diddity-do to go round and around and around we go. Hey, hey, our magic is good in every way. When nighttime falls and moonbeams crawl, he journeys to a very, very far away land. He hops on the back of a dragonfly. They take off together through midnight skies over rainbow bridges to the land of dreams. Then he settles up the sewers on a purple sea. There are stars in the ocean and pearls in the sky, and a child behind every twinkle of an eye. All peaceful creatures dance their dreams. They live a life they know can be. They sing, go, go, eh. Ha-ha! Let's play a rig-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a all day. Well, back to a crazy world where some believe in magic and then there's others that don't. It's strictly mythological, you know, it's irrational. It's demonic and satanical. Wow, man, it's cosmically working on delusional. Can't convince me. I'm cynical and skeptical. Ah, fa-da-lum, da-da-lum, da-da-lum, da-da-yo. Fa-da-lum, da-da-lum, da-da-lum, da-da-yo. I'm simply supernatural in a true, beautiful way. Well, if you haven't flown on dragon's wings or sang with a bird or listened to a tree, and if you think you know everything, then in essence, you stop listening. The children flown on dragon's wings, they sing with the birds and listen to the trees, they dance to the rhythm of their own heartbeat. They tap, 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 and it's mysteries. They sing, fuddle-lum, diddle-lum, little-lum, day. The world of magic is always at play. Fuddle-lum, diddle-lum, what haste all things good thoughts every day. They sing, fuddle-lum, diddle-lum, diddle-lum, day. Oh, fuddle-lum, diddle-lum, little-lum, day. So things good thoughts every day. If you open your heart like a child's eyes, you'll find there's a whole new world outside.
Little Tim McGuire loved to play with fire. Always hated water, never used to wash. Loved the smell of burning, of bonfires burning. Loved to play all day with his little tinderbox. He chased the sparks as they flew into the evening. Hail the flash of lightning and the burning sun. When I'm a man, I'm going to be a fireman. Then I can light a fire for everyone.